Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world to WFIU listeners. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest on this occasion is Artyom Troitsky, the best-known journalist, organizer, critic, and promoter of rock music in Russian. Artyom, welcome to Profiles.
Hello, Owen.
You were born in 1955, the middle of the decade that gave birth to rock music in the United States. Was there something in your family background that helped develop your interest in rock music?
Well, I think the only thing that has really helped to develop my interest is the fact that back in 1963, my parents went to work in Prague, the capital of now non-existent country, then called Czechoslovakia, now, of course, the capital of Czech Republic. And I've been living in Prague from 1963 till 1968. And I live there in an international community. So around me, there's been a lot of kids from other countries, which included also so-called Western countries, like Italy and France. They were all children of prominent communists from this country, but this didn't prevent them from listening to fashionable music of that time, and this was, of course, rock and roll music. So I first heard rock and roll in 1963, and there were, of course, 7-inch singles by the Beatles and the Beach Boys and some similar bands from Western Europe, and I immediately loved the music because it was completely different from everything I've heard before that. I mean, the electric sound, you know, the sheer joy and energy of it. Of course, it couldn't be compared with Soviet patriotic songs and military marches. So I became a rock fan in one moment, and like many other kids of my age, I was a very dedicated fan. For me, it wasn't enough only to listen to fantastic songs and dance to them and kiss girls to them, but I also wanted to know, you know, who are those people who play and sing and what are the songs about. And this is actually how I've learned English. I'm 100% self-taught, and, you know, I just listen to these songs and sat there with dictionaries, translated these songs and so on. And by the time when I've started to study English at school, I already spoke English better than my teacher.
When you went back to the Soviet Union, was it difficult? Because at that point, rock music wasn't accepted and really wasn't that much available, was it, in Russia?
Of course, it was difficult, but I think it was rather difficult for me for purely personal reasons. I mean, I didn't have any friends back in Moscow, and, you know, the whole lifestyle was totally kind of alien to me. And the climate was also much harder. So, yes, well, I remember the first year of two of my post-Prague being in Moscow. It's been really tough for me. From the musical point of view, I was very lucky because of some of my Prague friends who returned to Moscow before me. I have met local rock musicians and was introduced to the local underground rock scene. And, you know, like I was visiting the very first rock concerts in Prague back in 66 and 67. I also became a rock club frequent visitor in Moscow. Of course, everything was far, far less developed in the Soviet Union rock-wise. In Czechoslovakia, rock bands had access to radio and TV, and they've made records. And they've had rock festivals in Czechoslovakia. Nothing like that happened in the Soviet Union. And the whole rock scene was put very deeply into underground. And also at the first stage in the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, all Russian rock bands, they've been actually cover version bands. They, you know, they didn't write their own songs, and they only played their versions of songs by, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, later Jimi Hendrix, Cream, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, and so on. So it only was at the end of the 70s that we've started to have any convincing examples of rock music in Russian language.
From what I've read, it's my understanding that for the larger population in Russia, the first interest in rock music developed from the Beatles. Why the Beatles?
Well, you're absolutely right. The early American rock and roll, the 50s rock and roll, Elvis, Bill Haley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry and so on, they never really caught up in Russia and the Soviet Union. And I think, and my theory, which sounds quite convincing to me at least, is that this has happened because American rock and roll was too unusual for a Russian ear, Russian or Slavic in general. American rock and roll was primarily about rhythm. You know, it was those rhythm and blues rhythms, minimal melodies, maximum drive. And, you know, this is not exactly the kind of music that is traditionally loved and appreciated by Russians. Russians are rather sentimental people. They like melodic songs. They like to sing along with these songs. Well, of course, first they like to get seriously drunk and then sing along. And, you know, and of course, you know, it's quite difficult to sing Tutti Frutti or even Heartbreak Hotel, you know, when you're drunk and sit there at a table embracing similarly drunk ladies and gentlemen. So I think it's primarily for this reason that American rock and roll sounded too exotic and couldn't really become a massively popular thing. But when Russian youngsters heard the Beatles, they immediately thought that, you know, this is our music. Because, you know, the Beatles, of course, they've kind of combined the electric American and Afro-American rock and roll with this kind of schmaltzy and melodic old European song tradition. And this was something completely different.
How did they hear the music? The question has to do with what were the sources of it. Later on, one had cassette recorders, but how did Russians get introduced to the early music? Was it other people like you that had spent time in Eastern Europe or Western Europe?
Well, I think I was rather an exclusion because very few Russian kids were lucky enough to live abroad. Well, the sources were rather different, but I would say that the two main sources were A, Western radio stations, and this was the times when music occupied a huge part in the transmissions of such Western propaganda stations as the Voice of America and BBC Russian Service and Deutsche Welle and so on. So a lot of us listened days and nights we listened to all kinds of radio stations. Like, you know, I was very dedicated, and I would say a very professional shortwave fan. And I've had a big timetable of different stations, you know, with frequencies. And my favorite was the Romanian Radio Free Europe. Of course, I didn't know the Romanian language, but they had a fantastic DJ there named Cornel Kiriac, and he was one of the very few DJs at these stations who didn't only play current hits, you know, the singles, but he also played sometimes entire albums by artists who I like. So Radio Europa Libere, and this is how they were called in Romanian, they've been a station I listen to every night.
And that you would have the advantage that the Russians would not be jamming the Romanian service.
Yes, exactly. The Voice of America and the BBC, they've been jammed, and of course they, you know, they didn't care at all about the Romanian Radio Free Europe. So radio was one very important source of information. By the way, before rock and roll, radio was as important in the introduction of jazz music in the Soviet Union. And Willis Conover, a famous American jazz DJ on The Voice of America, he was the biggest jazz star of all. I mean, in the Soviet Union, Mr. Jazz wasn't neither Duke Ellington or Louis Armstrong or Miles Davis or Charlie Parker or John Coltrane. Mr. Jazz was Willis Conover, and a hugely iconic figure.
And somebody that most Americans never heard of.
Yeah. But he was really monumental in the Soviet Union in the 50s and the 60s. So the second important source was the black market. All Western records were on the black market, and they costed a lot. I mean, a brand new sealed album by a popular rock band could cost up to 70 or 80 rubles, and the average monthly wage in the Soviet Union at that time was 150 rubles. So a lot of people, a lot of young people, would pay like half of their monthly income to buy one LP by Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin or Grand Funk Railroad. The black market, of course, was a rather criminal thing, as every black market in every country. It was operated partly by students from the third world countries, and we've had a lot of those students from Africa and Latin America who studied at Soviet universities, but on the way to their native lands and back, they've bought Western records in Berlin or Paris or London or whatever, and then sold them here and made huge profit, of course. I think that Western vinyl albums were as hot as American blue jeans on the black market and Marlboro cigarettes. But also some Soviets dared to bring records to the black market. They were mostly sportsmen and diplomats and sailors, but also some more exotic personalities. I've had friends in the Bolshoi Ballet, so I've asked them to bring me the records I needed.
Well, you, I guess, became famous for the first time, at least at the university level, when you were a student and conducting discos in the student dormitory. Was there some risk in that?
Well, I think that I really was the first DJ in Moscow and most probably in Russia and also quite probably in the whole of the Soviet Union. Actually, the concept of disco was totally unknown in the country then. At that time, it wasn't dangerous at all simply because nobody knew what is this. So I played records and students danced, and I've also had stories there told about my favorite bands. And actually, this is how I became a rock journalist. A lady from a popular youth magazine once came to one of my discos where I've been, I think, talking about Frank Zappa or someone. And after my performance, she came to me and said, well, you're exactly the person who we need, because we get a lot of letters from our readers and they all want to know about popular Western pop bands. And I've asked all our professional music journalists and critic, and they all told me that they have no idea what is this music and whether it's music at all. Most probably it's just some kind of monkey sounds. So this is how I became a rock critic and a music journalist. But it wasn't dangerous at all. I've had to stop my DJing activities after 2 years, because then it became popular and there were already several more discos at the university. So the university Komsomol is the Young Communist League. I mean, you know, the ideological guys who overlooked, you know, all kinds of youth activities in the university. They came up to me and said, "Okay, well, if you're playing at a disco, we need to check your playlists." And I said, "Well, it's no way that I can submit my playlists to you, because I improvised. You know, I don't really know what kind of music I will play. I have a pile of records with me, and I play them depending on my mood, you know, the mood of the audience and so on." And they said, "No way. You know, you have to give us a playlist. We will study it. We will edit out the titles which we find ideologically suspicious. And then, of course, we will sign and seal it. And this is how you can be a DJ." And, of course, I said, "No, I'm not going to work under such conditions."
What was the concern of the authorities, whether in the Komsomol or the secret police? Was it cultural? Was it ideological? Was it political? What were the concerns?
I think there were several concerns. The KGB and the Komsomol and the Communist Party, they were mostly obsessed with ideological matters. So they didn't like rock music and tried to get rid of it, primarily because they've seen it as a sign of Western decadence, Western influence. Generally speaking, you know, some kind of ideological virus which contaminates young Russian people. Then there was another force which fighted rock from a different perspective, and this was the Union of Soviet Composers. You know, the most powerful Soviet music organization. And they've been fighting rock approximately from the same positions as many American conservatives fighted rock back in the 50s. They said that this is degenerate music or monkey music, music which is not a music at all.
I think this was an article in Literaturna Gazeta. This is a plague which unfortunately cannot be cured at this time. This is the moral equivalent of AIDS, and we cannot find any remedies for it. This is not just music. This is a medium by which our young people are being drugged. This is the turf on which everything can grow, starting with drug addiction and prostitution and finishing with high treason and criminal offenses. I don't think we should ban rock music, but this is a ravine into which our young boys and girls are sliding.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, I've read some American articles from the mid-50s which said exactly the same things.
To what degree was it the fear of Western influences, and to what degree was it fear of undermining the Communist Party within the Soviet Union?
Well, I don't think that the concerns went as deeply as undermining the Communist Party. Of course, this was simply music. And I think that a stronger suspicions became evident already in the beginning of the 80s, when we've had a lot of Russian rock bands writing their songs with a certain degree of social and political command. Then I heard for the first time that that rock music is anti-Soviet and dangerous for the state, not only for the moral status of Soviet youth. But this was a little later. This was in like 82, 83, 84, when we've had plenty of Russian punk rock and new wave bands which sang very direct and very outspoken songs about, well, not exactly about the Communist Party, but about, you know, the stupidity of life in the Soviet Union, the lack of freedom, the oppression, the alienation, and so on. And at that time, there began a real war on rock music, and actually the whole genre has been banned in the whole country. Like, I was also blacklisted, I couldn't publish my articles for a couple of years, and each concert could end up in a police raid, and a lot of rock performers went to jail or were suspended from any kind of public activities. This was the scene in the years like 82, 85. But then, of course, came Mikhail Gorbachev and Perestroika and Glasnost, and they have rescued the whole scene.
We'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. First, I wonder if you could share with us some selection of rock music that you particularly like.
I think we cannot pass by Kino, led by the late, great Viktor Tsoi, the biggest Russian rock icon, who got killed in a car crash in 1990, but throughout the 80s were, you know, the most popular Russian rock performer, really a very talented person who I think could have become an international rock star, because he was interesting, handsome, charismatic. He was half Russian, half Korean. I think that the music of Kino is also timeless. I mean, from time to time I hear some Western rock band sound exactly like Kino in the mid-80s.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
Before we talk about how things changed with the advent of Gorbachev and Glasnost, did the Soviet regime make any effort to counter rock music by the creation of some kind of popular music for Soviet youth?
Yes. Well, indeed, the Western rock music became so big in the 60s and the 70s that the so-called counter-propaganda divisions of both cultural and security institutions in the Soviet Union, they felt the urge to introduce a certain alternative to it. Because the traditional and the official Soviet pop music, the so-called estrada, was tremendously conservative. I mean, you know, it looked and sounded, you know, like Perry Como or Frank Sinatra or Connie Francis in the 50s, and this was still in the 60s and the 70s. And of course, young people, they wouldn't subscribe to such musics and styles. So they've introduced the so-called VIAs, or VIAs, vocally instrumental ensembles, which were like, again, Soviet official pop music, but arranged in a modern way with electric guitars, synthesizers, brass sections, and so on. Musically, many of them followed in the footprints of American so-called brass rock bands like Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago.
I guess another distinction I would like to ask you to talk about is between the official and unofficial rock bands. What kind of difference did that make in the development of rock?
Well, we've had this official and unofficial scene only in the 80s, I think, also at the end of the 70s. And the main difference was that the unofficial rock bands, they couldn't undertake any professional activities. I mean, they couldn't get access to TV or radio. They never made any records. And also, they didn't have rights to receive money for their public performances. So those luckiest of them who were allowed to play in public at all, they were considered the so-called художественная самодеятельность, the artistic self-activity, which is like an amateur activity. So they could be allowed to play at like school parties or at some factory clubs, but not in real professional theaters, concert venues, let alone sports arenas.
You mentioned that early on there was a use of English language lyrics. What was it that finally motivated the change to significant Russian lyrics?
It's a good question, Owen. I think that the main reason was that we've had some very convincing authors like Andrei Makarevich from Time Machine, Boris Grebenshikov from Aquarium, Viktor Tsoi from Kino, Yuri Shevchuk, and they have created this trend of meaningful Russian language rock songs, and they have created this whole phenomena which is up to this day is called Ruskiy Rok, Russian Rock. And maybe the most important feature of Russian rock is that it values the message, song, lyrics above the musical quality. So a very normal thing about typical Russian rock bands is that they play rather badly and you definitely can't dance to it. And like the funky element and the sexy element is zero, but the lyrics are fantastic. And I think that generally speaking, the poetical quality of Russian rock music is probably higher than the one of, say, American or British rock music. I mean, of course, you have several genius rock poets like Bob Dylan or Jim Morrison, or, I don't know, Captain Beefheart. But they are rather an exclusion, whereas almost every big Russian rock personality must be also a very talented poet.
One thing that's very absent from the rock music in the Soviet days is women. Why is that?
Why so few women?
Yes.
I think, again, this is my theory, which doesn't have a proof. But I think that in the early days, rock music was simply a very dangerous occupation. So, of course, we've had so-called groupies, but the music itself was created by risky, adventurous, and rather brutal young men. So later, when rock music became just an integral part of pop music and show business in the nowadays Russia, the situation has changed and now we have plenty of girls. In rock, we have all-girl bands, we have famous female rock stars. So now I think the gender balance in Russian rock is more or less maintained.
Let's go back then to the coming to power of Gorbachev in 1985. What was the impact on rock music?
Well, I think that rock music was among those activities which benefited most from the arrival of glasnost and perestroika, because the whole genre of rock music has been immediately lifted from the underground to sports arenas and stadiums. And all those rock bands who've been banned and whose recordings have been distributed on illegal tapes and cassettes, they've immediately, within a blink of an eye, they became national celebrities, sold out big venues, started to make a lot of money, started to represent new perestroika Russian culture abroad. A lot of Russian bands have made contracts with Western record labels, like Boris Grebenshikov from Aquarium signed with then CBS Columbia and released an international album in the US and Western Europe. Gorky Park have signed with Polygram, now Universal, and Zvukimu have signed with Warner Bros. And recorded an album with Brian Eno as producer. There's been a plenty of interesting things going on then. But there was also one bad thing, because, you know, this classic formation of Russian rock has been created as an oppositional tool, and they've been inspired by fighting back the regime, the government, the Komsomol and everything associated with it. So when suddenly they became the regime itself, a lot of bands, they kind of, felt absolutely lost. They didn't know what to sing about and what to do. And this was the situation in the beginning of the 90s, when, this whole Russian rock phenomenon suddenly cracked down and has been replaced by other genres. First of all, the so-called popsa, which is the Russian equivalent for bad quality, bland pop music.
Did Gorbachev himself ever address rock music, talk about it, what he expected from it, what he thought about it?
No. I know Mikhail Gorbachev personally quite well, and he never was a rock fan. He himself, he was born in 1931, so by no means he belongs to a rock generation, and he likes to sing. He likes music in general, and he always tries to sing when he drinks, and he likes to drink up to these days. And the music he likes is basically Russian folk music. He adores singing Cossack songs and Russian folk songs, and also some songs of the time of the Great Patriotic War and so on. But he has nothing to do with rock music. And unlike many other current Russian leaders, he has never flirted with rock musicians.
Let's pause now to listen to more music you particularly like.
Another prominent 90s act is a band called Mumitroll, led by Ilya Lagutsenko, which I think is like the first Russian rock band of the new kind of postmodernist formation. Very eclectic, very ironic, and very much West orientated.
Чем спасают, здорово, великолепно. Бьешься за жизнь, за завтра и даже иногда за меня. Как бы тебе повезло.
Your own role in Soviet media, or should we say post-Soviet media, has changed over time. For a while, you were on doing television programs. What exactly were those programs about?
Well, I think I've always seen my role as primarily not really a teacher, let alone a guru, but as a person who enlightens people and informs them about what's happening. So this is why I wrote back in the Soviet times about Western rock music mostly. I simply wanted the kids to know what is rock music, what are the styles, what is good and what is bad about pop music in general and so on. Then I've started to write a lot about local Russian and Soviet bred rock music. Of course, when I became a more or less officially recognized person, not just an advocate of underground music, I've been offered to do TV shows and radio shows, and I do them up to these days. My radio show goes on for more than two decades now. And I think it may be compared to what John Peel has been doing in the UK. I mostly play alternative and off-mainstream and non-chart music of different styles. Could be electronic, alternative rock, freak folk, lo-fi, psychedelic, ethnic, whatever, from all over the world. And I try my best to be as anti-imperialistic as possible. So, of course, American and British music still occupies big part of my, well, about half of my radio show. But I try to play also music from smaller European countries, Asia, Japan, Latin America, and so on. And I also teach at universities. And I currently have two TV shows in Russia. One is more or less late-night talk show based on my comments on current music videos, which are usually rather nasty. And another one, and it's called Professor Troitsky and Comrade Artemy. So it's a bit like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of show. In one person, indeed. Then another one on our national channel called Kultura, Culture. It's called The Kings and Queens of Song. And this is a show in which I tell stories about classic pop performers like Edith Piaf, Judy Garland, Paul Anka, Stevie Wonder, you know, this kind of monumental figures of the pop past. And I also teach at two universities in Russia. I occasionally release records on my label, thus helping some new upcoming underground talents. I'm still very excited about music, and unlike many people of my age, I don't feel that the music has degraded since the 60s and the 70s. Well, I think the importance of music has decreased since that time. That's for sure. I mean, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, rock music was like, you know, the spine, you know, the main resource of all youth culture. I don't think this is the case right now. But still, I think there's a plenty of interesting music and talented people working in this field. So along with my green activities, and I'm a big environmental activist, and some political adventures, you know, I still do a lot in the musical field.
You're now in your mid-50s. Do you feel it more difficult to keep in touch with current musical trends?
It definitely is much more difficult to keep in touch with current musical trends now, simply because it's not as clearly organized as it used to be. Because before we've had a music press and records. And it was, you know, it was like a city with streets, street signs, houses, and so on. And now all music exists in the internet. And internet is more like a jungle with dark paths. And it's very difficult to orientate in the internet, or it takes a lot of time to find something that... that you might like. And I'm afraid I don't have enough time to find all the music that I might find interesting in the internet. You know, I still find a lot, but it doesn't come as easy as before.
How would you describe the current state of rock music in Russia?
Well, if you asked me this question 2 or 3 years ago, I think I'd rather give you a pessimistic picture, because in these zeros of the 21st century, I think the whole scene was very stale, very boring. There were no new names, and, you know, I've just had this feeling that the scene slowly dies. But right now, maybe thanks to the political developments in the country, and of course, you know, our establishment gives all the good causes for all kinds of protest movements. And I always thought that the best rock music has been born under stress, you know, be it Vietnam War or economic crisis during the punk rock explosion. I think that right now the scene is more vibrant than it used to be in the previous 20 years. We have plenty of new bands in Russia, and indeed the main environment and the main source of inspiration for this newest wave of Russian rock music is the internet. Internet helps these bands to feel absolutely and totally independent from the state. They don't need the state-controlled TV, and all TV in Russia is state-controlled. They don't need commercial FM radio stations. They don't need music press, although it barely exists in Russia. And all those YouTubes and MySpaces and Facebooks, they give them much more opportunities than the traditional media. Therefore, also the trend, which is very visible in Russia right now, and that is English language bands.
Do Dmitry Medvedev, the president, and Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, have any views about rock music in general that you know of?
Vladimir Putin knows very little about rock music, and actually has rather bad tastes in rock music. I mean, he once said that his favorite rock band is a German heavy metal group called the Scorpions. But generally speaking, he's not a rock person. He rather likes Soviet patriotic songs and pop crooners. But Dmitry Medvedev is a fully legalized and outspoken rock fan, and he likes the classic English rock music of the 70s. He's been cited as saying that his favorite bands are Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, would you believe it, and Deep Purple. He has a fantastic hi-fi, high-end audio system at home, which audiophiles estimated at about $200,000 worth of money. Medvedev is exactly the guy who, unlike Mikhail Gorbachev, likes to flirt with rock music and rock musicians.
Do you think the Russian authorities in general now are willing to sort of let rock music exist and not interfere in any way, assuming that it's going to perhaps influence some people, but that it's not a threat?
Well, I think that rock music has been fully legalized and recognized officially already 20 years ago. I mean, since then, there's been absolutely no question of whether rock music has a right to exist in Russia. There's no question about it. And now, you know, when, you know, the head of the Russian state is rock fan, of course, you know, there can't be any questions about that. The problem is not about the genre. The problem is about the contents of the songs. And here, still some rock bands, including the DDT of Yuri Shevchuk and my favorite band, a band called Barto, an electropunk band from Moscow, and some others, as well as some socially and politically active rappers and hip-hoppers, they are still facing some problems in Russia. They're not the problems of the kind that rock musicians have been facing in the beginning of the 80s. It's not that their songs are banned and they are banned from public performances and so on. But still, they don't have access to any state-controlled media, be it radio or TV. They have some problems with police. Noise MC, the best-known and most outspoken Russian rapper, has been arrested recently in Volgograd after performing a song which was very critical of Russian police forces. And the same thing is now happening with Barto, because they've participated at political rallies in Moscow and also sang songs which were considered as extremist activities. So such things are still happening in Russia, but frankly speaking, I'm glad that this is happening, you know, because it gives this scene, you know, this kick in the ass, you know, it makes it more vibrant, it makes it more dangerous. And I think that above all, rock and roll is adventure.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been Artyom Troitsky, Russia's first rock DJ, music journalist, and entrepreneur. Artyom, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Owen. All the best.
And we close with more music, some selection of rock music that you particularly like.
I would suggest a lady named Zemfira, who became the first Russian female rock star, is very talented. And she was probably the biggest and the most happening person on the Russian rock scene. We'll be right back.
затаилась и ждет, что же будет. Мы с тобою в желе, знай, коробке. Ты давно не любовь, просто чем-то похожие люди.
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2010. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.